Well, good morning. It's amazing to be with you today and to see the church so much fuller than it has been over this past kind of period. And I'm seeing lots of very familiar faces to me, and I'm also seeing many new ones as well. And if you are new here today, as Abby and Emily said, we really pray and hope you feel super welcome here, that you just feel like this can be a home for you. And we just want to say thank you for being here. We think it's wonderful that you've joined us today. For those who don't know me, my name is Liam. I'm part of the staff team here. And for a number of years now, I've led Defined, which is our youth community for 11s through to 18-year-olds. And it's been just a joy, an absolute joy to do that. And I hope and pray that my kids one day will get to be a part of it. I'm married, to the wonderful, very much the better half of the Brennan duo, Jo. She's at home with the kids today, doing kids church, watching what's it's being thrown. I'm guessing she'll be the target today. But she's great. She's wonderful. We have been part of this church for maybe 10 years now, I think. I was trying to work it out. And we just love this place. We love the people here. They've inspired us so much to follow Jesus, to seek him more closely. And it's just an amazing community to be a part of. So I really do hope if you're new, you feel like this can be a special place for you, because it really is. As a church community, if you've been away over the summer, or you're new, you're coming back, stepping in again, we've been thinking about neighbouring. We've been calling this series The Practice of Neighbouring. And we've been reflecting on Jesus's commandment, well, the second half, really, of that great commandment that he gives his disciples, to love our neighbours as ourselves. And we've been thinking, you know, what does it look like for us to take really simple steps to connect with, to serve, to love the people that are on our streets, that are in our neighbourhoods? And today, we're kind of thinking about our motivation for doing that. Why our motivation matters, and not necessarily why we love our neighbours, because that is something that Tom, our leader here, has already shared on, but namely like how our motivations shape the way that we live that out in our daily lives. But I've got a question for you if we're thinking about motivation today, just to kind of have in your head, and you don't need to turn and talk to people about this one, because it might be something that's maybe a bit intimate to you, but I wonder, what is it that motivates you to do something? What is it that drives you to do the things that you do? Maybe it's a career that you have. Maybe it's a voluntary interest that you give a lot of time and energy to. Maybe it's your hobbies, the interests, the things that you do in your spare time. What motivates you? What drives you to do those things? Just maybe have that kind of in your head today. As I was thinking about this, I was thinking about running. I always bang on about running because that's generally all I do outside of church, but other than parenting, of course. But I love running. There's many reasons why I'm motivated to run. It keeps you fit. I want to be a fit and healthy dad as I grow up. That'd be ideal. It's cheap. You just get a pair of running shoes, away you go. And as an introvert, and I'm a big old introvert, really deep down, it's just time in your own thoughts. And for me as a parent with three small kids, it is sanctuary to go out and have an hour hitting the streets, believe me. So there's many reasons why I'm motivated to run. But actually, I think the biggest reason is I love the fact that with running, you can compete against yourself. Very much it's about kind of self-betterment. And I'm running the Sheffield Half Marathon in a few weeks' time. There might be a few people here who are doing that as well. And whilst I can't get back to the level that I was at when I was 18, 19, I don't know how I did it back then, obviously pre-kids, clearly. But what's motivating me this year is to better my previous time on that course, to see if I can go faster, and to kind of just about hang on to the fact that I am, well, as I claim, still in my prime, although other people would beg to disagree, in my mid-30s now. But I love running, and I think this is why apps like Strava kind of hook you in, because it gets you into that mindset of performing against yourself. So you look at your run and you see whether you've been trending faster on a particular course, whether you've set a PB. If you run a section enough times, you can become a local legend in your own right, people. And I've got that proud title for a couple of areas of Sheffield, Encliffe Road downhill being one of them. But You know, if my mum was, you know, she's listening back to this at some point, she'd be very proud of me for that, I'm sure. That's the positive side of Strava, but there is a darker side to it, folks. And it's mainly obviously the human heart that's causing that. But for people like me, you can look at it, you can follow other people, and you can start to rank yourself against each other and where you stack up on the leaderboard. Some people can achieve the very minor, and it is minor glory, I should say, of a crown, of becoming a king or a queen of a particular section, basically getting the fastest time over a little section, which I've done on one or two occasions. But what I've noticed about this is it brings out the worst in me, because what Strava really helpfully do is when you've achieved the crown, they tell you about it, but when somebody else comes along and they get a faster time, and they knock you off your perch, they send you a little notification to say that your crown has gone. And I must confess that in those moments, I often feel an intense dislike and annoyance towards some random member of the public that I have no real knowledge of, except the fact that they have stolen my crown. And I must confess, there's been a couple of very, very dark moments where I've often thought, what would happen if I just got in the car, drove out, and sprinted that particular section of a run, got the crown again, and logged it as a run? What would people think? I'll leave that to you to decide. But what I'm trying to say in all of that is that our motivations to do something, as noble even as running, can have a hidden kind of agenda to it, an ulterior motive behind it. And I think the big idea really I'd love for us to explore this morning in the time that we've got is that our desire to love our neighbours well isn't or shouldn't be motivated necessarily by an end goal that we've got in mind, a result that we're hoping to achieve, but actually it's motivated by a person that we're seeking to follow more closely, that we're motivated to be good neighbours by Jesus. And today we're going to be looking at two passages actually today, so two for the price of one today, folks, from the Bible, which kind of help us understand this better and maybe think about how we can be motivated to love our neighbours in a more Christ-like way. So the first passage, we're going to dive into this now, should appear hopefully on the screen behind me, if it's up there. And these are words from Matthew chapter 5. Now, if they don't appear, if you've got a Bible, it's Matthew chapter 5, and there's a little section, oh, there it is, verses 14 to 16. I'm just going to read these for us now. These are very familiar words to many of us, taken from Jesus' most famous teaching, many would say the Sermon on the Mount. And he says this, "You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on a stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." Just amazing words, which I'm sure many of us have heard lots of times before. As I was thinking about them today, it's kind of caused me to stop and think about why we do what we do. And as part of this series on neighbouring, some of us have been reading a book called The Art of Neighbouring, which I think Tom has loosely borrowed this series for, perhaps not loosely. And essentially, one of the things that's really challenged me as I've read this is that it's very easy, I think, for us as Christians to view our relationships and the fact that and how we're motivated to form relationships with other people for perhaps reasons that maybe actually aren't the best when we come to think about them. So essentially, what they say in this book is that we can be motivated to make friends with people for the sole reason sometimes of wanting to convert them to the Christian faith. And that kind of hit me quite hard. And there's a quote in that book, which I think Tom read in the first week, and I'm going to read it for us again. And it says this. So from a church leader, he writes, "We don't love our neighbours to convert them. We love our neighbours because we're converted." And that's really like hit me quite hard, actually. See, it's not just what we do, it's why we do it that matters. And when it comes to living out our faith, our motivation does matter. And if our only motive for loving the people on our street and in our communities is to convert them to the Christian faith, to talk to them maybe about Jesus, as good as that is, as beautiful as that is, then actually have we maybe missed the point a little bit? As I was thinking about this, and I say this with real love, trust me, I sometimes struggle with when people are trying to sell me something. Maybe somebody's knocking on the door trying to sell me something or on the phone. And if there are any salespeople today in the house, you are loved by Jesus. And please just take this next bit with a big pinch of salt, because there's plenty of flaws with me too. But I don't know, sometimes I feel like in that moment, maybe I'm being treated slightly as a project. Maybe somehow I'm slightly devalued by this sales process. Maybe I'm a number on a graph, driving up someone's commission. Maybe that's just me. But you know, if we do stuff for our neighbors simply to try and tell them about Jesus, to get them into the kingdom, to get them to come and be part of church, then do you know what? I don't maybe think we're being the best neighbors that we can be, even the neighbors that God would want us to be. And maybe that we've missed the point, as that quote kind of points out. See, discipleship is, when we boil it down, simply trying to live as the people that God created us to be. And we do that, and if we do that with the right posture of heart, then Jesus's words here will encourage us that people will see and will experience something of the goodness and the kindness of God. That every time we stop to take the bins out for somebody, every time we speak positively about our neighbours, even though sometimes they can be a pain and play their music a little bit too loud late in the evening, or, you know, every time we chat to people on the street and just simply say hello to them, like, that is all pointing to God and his beating heart that every single one of us as precious human beings made in his image. I mean, that is a compelling reason to love. I don't know about you. And there's a reason why we've been looking at this command to love others as ourselves, and why Jesus doesn't just suggest it. It's not just like good advice, like if you've got enough time and energy, you're having a good week, everything's lined up for you, go and do this. Jesus flat out commands his followers to do this. And he does so because it's following in his footsteps. Loving our neighbors isn't something that we do because we have to. It's something that we do because we get to. As followers of him, becoming a good neighbor and loving others well is a priority for us because Jesus is the highest priority in our life. And if we seek him, we want to be closer to him, that is going to spill out into the way that we live and the way that we love the people around us. But as I've alluded to with running earlier, so often our actions and our motivations for doing them sometimes don't sync up. They don't match up. I don't know about you. And in this passage, Jesus uses the imagery of us being like a city on a hill reflecting God's glory. It's a wonderful image. But as I read this, I don't know, I was challenged to think about this question when it comes to neighboring. Whose glory am I doing it for? One of the challenges I've observed in my own life, really, is that there is a desire to strive, to be driven, to be motivated, to better myself, as I've talked about, but also to see how I am comparing and stacking up with other people. And I can do that with running, but sure as heck, I can do that with my walk with Jesus. And I say this in a way, I hope it helps people, but sometimes when I hear people share in our church wonderful stuff that they're doing, like, I don't know, I organized a street party for our neighbors, or we've got this new thing called happy hour going on where we all come out and have a glass of gin or whatever. Sounds wonderful, by the way. Someone should start that on our street. Or where we've given like an Easter egg to every person on our street, or a gift to every new student. In one breath, I'm like, that is amazing. I love that, God. That's wonderful. And then actually, there's a side of me that's saying, I just feel bad. I just feel like, I don't know, God, like, I'm not doing enough on my street. Like, I don't even know the names of half of the people on my street. I'm not even sure I like some of the people on my street. And I wonder, maybe it's not just me that sometimes thinks like that. And personally, I've recognized there are times during this COVID period where I have felt almost like a pressure to generate mission on the street, because that's what success for the kingdom of God looks like in this period. And I wonder if there's maybe others out there that would attest to that. But you know what? When we go and do that and we view things like that, all we've gone and done is put a big old weight around our necks, that the Jesus we've just sung about this morning, the beautiful Savior, longs to relieve us of, so much so that he went to the cross that we could put to death this sense of having to compete and to compare ourselves with other people. And that this sense in which actually, no matter how many neighbors we connect with or we don't connect with, no matter how many people we tell about Jesus or not, it's not going to change how much God loves us one iota. And yet, we can't help but be challenged by those words of Jesus today in that passage. There's a theologian, John Mark Comer, and he wrote a book called Garden City. And there's this really great quote in it, which I love. It says this: discipleship to Jesus, being a follower of Jesus, is about one simple question. If Jesus were me, if he lived on my street, in my city, had my job, my education, my salary, my family, etc., how would he live? And I think learning to become a good neighbor, learning to be a good disciple of Jesus, really just the same thing. And the more we fall in love with Jesus, the more we spend time with him, the more we want to live like him and love the people around us like he would. Jesus uses another image in that passage of us being like a lamp on a stand. A typical Jewish lamp was really small and it had to be placed quite high up to illuminate a room. And, you know, every time we choose to love our neighbors, you know, whether we think we're doing that well or not, however significant or insignificant we think that is, you know, it is all pointing to Jesus. It is all emanating something of his light in what is a very dark world. And actually, as I've come to know more and more people in my life, a great sense of darkness in which people live out their lives. The other day, I was heading home from work. It had been a long day. It's not always a long day at STC. There are many good days, but this one had been a long day. I was feeling knackered. I just wanted to get home, shut the door, kind of hide off from the world. Don't know if you ever think a little bit like that. But as I was turning the corner, I noticed my neighbor. And I did that fatal thing of catching his eye and then saying hello and following that up with, and how are you? That was the bit. And in that moment, he turned to me and he said, honestly, Liam, I'm having a, and I won't repeat the word he said after that, but he was having a bad day. Now, we've got to know that neighbor a little bit. He brought a bottle of wine over to our house one evening when we could do that. And so we know a bit about each other, but I could just tell in this moment he was having a really tough time. This is somebody who's widowed, who spends lots of time on their own. And just made me appreciate, actually, you know, I was 10 minutes late home from work that day. My tea was slightly colder than it would normally be. But for that person, that 10 minutes was absolutely wonderful. Like, it meant the world to him and our growing friendship. And as I was thinking about it, it just reminded me those simple, seemingly mundane things, stopping to talk to somebody on our way home from work, watering someone's garden while they're away on holiday, dropping a couple of beers on someone's step. It's not a lot, is it? But actually, it's God can and he does want to use that to show his kindness and his love to the people around us. We don't get to control what he does with that. That's in his hands. But what we do want to do is try and walk more closely with him. And I think that's what that passage is trying to get across. We've got another one to look at, but I've said a lot already. So just to give you a break from my voice, because I think you probably need it, 20 seconds or so, just pause. What's God saying to you this morning, personally? And if maybe you struggle with that question, what's God challenging you about maybe? Or just what's interested you, what stirred your heart? 20 seconds. We'll look at our final passage. One more thing, and then we'll worship again. So kind of given what we've already thought about, our motivation for loving our neighbours, what's happening in our hearts, we can sometimes feel a bit burdened by the fact that we're not doing enough, that it's just not quite going as we'd like. But actually, we can sometimes also feel, when we think about the heart behind neighbouring, that we're the only ones to do it. That, you know, we're the ones with the capacity, the resources, the get up and go, as it were, that when it comes to neighbouring, it's all on us. And our second passage today, and we're going to look at a less well-known one here, we're looking at Elijah, who's one of the key figures in the Old Testament. So we're going into the book of 1 Kings today, which is new territory for me for a little while. I think really challenges this notion. It's going to appear on the screens, hopefully behind me. Quick bit of context. This was written 900 years or so before Jesus. The people of God were ruled at this point by kings. The kingdom of God's people were divided into two, Israel in the north, Judah in the south. And we have this repeating pattern of a good king and then a bad king. And one of these bad kings was a guy called King Ahab, whom God then challenges by raising up a guy called Elijah to take God's message to him, to prophesy against him, and to call people back to God. And we pick up Elijah's story in chapter 17. At this point, a lot's happened already. He's prophesied a drought over the whole land. He's gone out into the wilderness, and there he's been fed by ravens, miraculously bringing him meat. He's drinking water from a stream, but his situation turns a little, takes a turn for the worst, to say the least. This is what happens next. Sometime later, the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. Then the word of the Lord came to him. Go at once to Zarephath in the region of Sidon and stay there. I have directed a widow there to supply you with food. So he, Elijah, went to Zarephath. When he came to the town gate, a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and asked, would you bring me a little water in a jar so that I may drink? As she was going to get it, he called, and bring me, please, a piece of bread. As surely as the Lord your God lives, she replied, I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little olive oil in a jug. I'm gathering a few sticks to take home to make a meal for myself and my son that we may eat it and die. Elijah said to her, don't be afraid. Go home and do as you've said. But first, take a small loaf of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me and then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil won't run dry until the day the Lord sends rain on the land. She went away and did as Elijah told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and her family, for the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil didn't run dry in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken to Elijah by Elijah. One of the most significant barriers when it comes to loving our neighbours well, as we've talked about, is our own heart. And that actually, often we can find ourselves maybe at odds with the gospel and often find ourselves thinking about ourselves before others. And we know that God blesses humility. He opposes the proud. But yet so often as Christians, when we come to think of neighbouring, we view it as something that we have to do ourselves, that it's all about us, that we're the ones to plan all the events. We have to meet everyone's need. And you know, when we look at this passage, I think it really challenges that kind of aspect of life really for us. Because in Elijah here, we've got someone whom God has anointed, who's set apart for a special task, who's prophesied a drought and it's come to pass. And yet he's someone who God has also taken to a low place. You know, so desperate is Elijah here for food and drink that he's relying on a poor widow, someone at that time who had no place in society, whom the Old Testament law dictated was actually to be kind of looked after by others. And here she is with the very last scrap of food looking after the great prophet Elijah. It must have been a profoundly humbling moment in his life. And you know, I think for us as being good neighbours, humility actually looks like not just thinking about what we can do for others, but what they can do for us. I think it looks like letting our neighbours love us too. Many of us will, of course, remember when lockdown hit and what that was like. As we entered that period, I'll never forget it for many reasons. One of them being that our eldest, Naomi, got chickenpox literally as soon as we entered that period. And then 2 weeks later, true to form, Isaac, our second boy, he also got chickenpox. And I remember trapped indoors, no parents or friends to help, lacking in sleep. We felt pretty helpless at that time. We'd read somewhere that if you bathe in porridge oats, a bit weird, but apparently it's meant to relieve the itchiness. So we were looking in our cupboards. We hadn't been to the shops for a while, as was happening at that time. We had nothing. We'd actually just shoved a load of cards through people's letterboxes at that point, saying, you know, we want to help you if you're struggling, you need some shopping, here's our numbers. We'd set up a WhatsApp group. First message that goes out on it is us with a desperate plea. Has anyone got any porridge oats so we can bathe one of our children in it? I look back now at it, I'm smiling. I wasn't at the time, believe me, I was close to tears. But it seemed like a little thing to us when this student came over with a bag of oats and a big smile. But looking back now, that was a huge thing. And actually, here we were thinking, we're going to go out and love and bless our neighbours. It's all on us. And we're the first ones in receipt of that. You can't really write that, can you? And I think being a great neighbour is as much learning to receive from others as it is to give. That's what it is to live in a community. And reflecting on Elijah here, making that ask of that widow, literally with the last scraps of food for her son, man, that must have taken some serious faith and obedience on his part. But through that step of vulnerability, man, God brings such blessing, doesn't he, through it. He provides enough oil, enough flour every day of the drought, and that was the 2-year period for Elijah, for the widow and her son. They never once go without. As we kind of step out, we open up our lives a little bit more. This is the real us. God's blessing breaks out, doesn't it? His kindness and his generosity is known. And I think, just to kind of like bring this to a close, really, this passage is kind of challenging this kind of neighborhood mentality that we can have. Like, we wear a superhero cape and we go around kind of solving everyone's problems. But actually, we need to allow other people to come and meet our needs as well. And as we do that, God can and he will bring blessing. And if we think that we're finding it hard to do that, and sometimes I do, that it's all on me, then we only need look at Jesus, the one who came to give us everything, and we've sung about today, was also willing to receive from us. You know, Jesus, at the start of his ministry, he lets his cousin John baptize him. Jesus, who often invited himself around to other people's houses for dinner, I mean, how cheeky was that? He relied on other people's hospitality. He hung around with people who many wouldn't have seen, you know, any value could be gained from knocking around with these people. They were shunned. Jesus, who, when I thought about it, often let other people support him emotionally, perhaps financially, when we think about it, relationally. Like, he didn't do life on his own. He had 12 guys around him for 3 years. You know, even on the cross, Jesus asks for water, yes, to fulfill prophecy, of course. But you know, even the one who came to be served, let others serve him. So if we think we can't do that, we only need look to Jesus. And when it comes to taking that command to love our neighbours as ourselves seriously, let him be our motivation. Let us ask Jesus to give us a fuller and wider perspective of who he is, that we might worship him, that we might glorify him, that we might draw closer to him, the one who's neighboured us, who's gone to the cross for us, the source of love. And let what leaks out be his kindness, his love, his generosity in our neighbourhoods and on our streets. Let our motivation be Jesus, and to God be the glory.